All right. Hello, everyone. So we are having some big tech difficulties with the, you know, the little service that we use for all of the exchange chats. So we may pivot. There's a couple things. We're still definitely going to do the exchange chat tonight, okay? So here's just one thing that we're going to do. We're going to try to see if we can get on and make this work just on our phones. So this is the second trial of this, and see if, and we're just going to see if this works out. We just kind of had to pivot here for a second. So one way that we can do this is first thing, try on the actual Facebook Live to see if it will work for us. So I'm just going to wait to see if Daphne comes in and we can try and add her to the conversation. The second way we can do this, which traditionally has worked very well in the past, is go to Google Hangouts via YouTube Live. I can send out a link and we can definitely make it work that way. So we are super excited to have you all. Really apologize about all of the tech difficulties. Let's see, and I'm going to see if I can find Daphne. There you are, Daphne. I see you now. Daphne, so I just invited you to the conversation. Let's see if this works. So Daphne, you should see something on your screen
right
now.
I see that. Hi.
Yes, all right. Awesome.
I got to do one thing. There we
okay,
go.
Take your time.
Hi.
All right, everyone. This is going to work out. We had to pivot, but thank you so much all. Thank you all for joining. This is not the traditional way we do exchange chats, but it's going to work, and you're going to get some really valuable information tonight. So thank you all for joining. Give me one sec. Let's make this all worth your while.
Now, can you hear me okay? I'm not connected via my headphones anymore.
Yes, I can hear you okay.
Okay. All right, beautiful.
I'm going to actually, you just reminded me.
So this was a beautiful demonstration of grit and determination.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right, everyone. So I have all of this up. Audio's great. Ryan, thank you so much. All right. So let me bring this up so I can see all of your comments. One sec. Daphne, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thanks, Cruz. And thanks for
Good.
Having me tonight.
Absolutely. All right, everyone, let's kick this off. So this is the July exchange chat. Tonight we're talking about emotions and empathy in the workplace with Daphne Scott. Very, very excited to have you, Daphne.
Thank you.
For all of our viewers that don't know you, can you just give just a rundown of who you are, what you've done? Obviously, you're a physical therapist, but maybe just a little bit more for people that don't know you.
Yeah, sure. So I am still a licensed physical therapist. I'm very proud of that fact, actually. I don't directly treat patients anymore, but had a very lucrative and enjoyable career doing that for about 22 years, and then really got into the world of leadership development and what did it take to create thriving cultures in an organization. So this was all based on my own experience. I was 30 years old and was promoted into a management position, and before I knew it, I had like 7 people reporting to me. I had no idea what I was doing. completely honest with you, it was sort of a disaster, actually. So, you know, people should just do what I say because I'm the boss, you know? And so I had a lot to learn about my own emotional intelligence and what it meant to be emotionally intelligent. And, you know, the word empathy wasn't even used, I mean, you know, in healthcare at that time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
a lot to learn. And then I, my career just took this really interesting trajectory, and I got very interested in leadership development and could we teach some really viable skills to support people to be better leaders, and what did it mean to be an effective leader? And of course, emotional intelligence really was fitting into all of that conversation. And so I became an executive coach, started doing coaching with people in the organization where I worked at the time, and then went out on my own and am still doing my own work in companies, a few companies here and there. But I'm really proud of most recently becoming the chief culture officer with Confluent Health and all their family of companies. So it was a really big experiment. Many people on the chat tonight probably know Dr. Larry Benz, and
yep.
He and I have been collaborating had been collaborating for a couple of years on some different things and different approaches, and he was really supportive of a coaching culture in the organization. And Dr. Rob Wehner is a coach in the organization, and we've really been able to create this way of working with leaders that has an incredible impact across the company, in all the companies, that involves emotional intelligence for sure, and then self-awareness. So self-awareness is really the foundation of being an aware, conscious, positive leader, and then you develop from self-awareness, then you can start getting into emotional intelligence. So that's the work that I get to do in the world, and I'm really blessed and really thankful that I get to do that. So,
wow.
Thank you.
that's incredible. So really quick, I just want to throw one more thing in. So the way I found you and the way I keep up with all of your work right now. So first off, the way I found you, I went, this was last year, so I was a second year DBT student. I went to WebPT Ascend, and I saw you give an incredible lecture. I went up to you afterwards, and we had a conversation, and it was about this. It was about empathy and emotions. And then most recently, I follow you on your podcast, the Super Fantastic Leadership Show, where you host a series of just incredible conversations about leadership. And one of the most recent ones that you talked about was negative emotions in the workplace. And man, you and your assistant, Marta, your co-host, were so funny during that conversation. But yeah, I just wanted to bring that up. So for those of you that don't know about Daphne's podcast, that's one of the things that I would highly, highly recommend following her work on that, because she gives some great pearls and just really valuable information, which I hope, you know, we'll share a little bit tonight about.
Yeah, so, for sure. I want to say that, you know, the idea of a negative emotion, I'd love to get into that more, because, you know, once we get through this idea that really no emotions are negative, but we have an experience of them being that way. So I'm really excited to get into that topic a little bit more. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. So we can jump right into that. So for those of you that are watching right now, you can start posting your questions and comments in the flow below, and we'll get those all answered for you tonight. But to give you a little bit of a starter, let's talk about this idea of negative emotions, and what you talked about in the podcast are just these neutral events happening, and we have these preferred emotions and non-preferred emotions, and thinking of it more as like thinking of it that way, right? Rather than these negative and positive things that are happening in our life. But I'll just give you an opportunity to just clear that up if I butchered it, but yeah.
Well, let's start really, you know, I like to, whenever I, you know, give talks or I'm working with people, I really like to start broad category, you know, and kind of come down to the funnel. Now, what I'm about to say is going to start almost sound like I'm starting at the bottom of the funnel, but you know, it helps to make some distinctions around what we mean by emotion. And I think this is the first place that we really, it's worthy of our time to understand. And so an emotion is really, at its basic level, is really only, and I say only, a set of sensations occurring in and on the body. So when, if we can just get with that for a second, now it feels so much more than that, right? It's like, if I start experiencing anger, it just feels like it's just, I'm not even aware of my body in most instances. And most of us aren't. We have a pretty disembodied culture. So if we can get first with, you know, emotions are really just a set of sensations occurring in and on the body, that kind of takes some of the energy away from it. I think, at least it did for me when I started understanding it that way, it's like, oh, okay, good. I can get with that. And then what we do to be able to, you know, speak to each other and be able to interact with each other is we label that emotion. So if I have sort of my heart racing, and I can feel heat on my face and, you know, some tension in my neck, I probably would label that as anger. Or if I'm about to get on Facebook Live and the technology isn't working correctly, I'm trying to connect with you and I feel this tightening in my stomach, I probably would label that as fear, some sort of, you know, anxiety. You know, there's over 500 different words that we can use to describe our different sort of emotional experience, right? So one of the things that sort of, it's interesting to say to people of like learning to sit with these emotions that, or these experiences that are uncomfortable. And it seems sort of counterintuitive to be like, well, why would I why in the world would I sit in something that makes me uncomfortable? And the truth is, you wouldn't. You know, and I think this is really the part where we are not, I know we're going to touch on empathy a little bit, but I think this is part of parcel of where we're not really empathetic with ourselves, because no one's going to sign up to be uncomfortable, really. But yeah. What we have to look at, right? I mean, it's just part of our experience as humans. We want to go towards the things that feel good, and we want to avoid the things that feel bad. And there's really not, right, in and of itself, any problem with that. What starts to happen, though, is we start to get into a situation where we have an emotion, we have something going on in our inner life, and then because we're not able to bring an equanimity to all of our experience, we start resisting our experience. And that's really, you know, some people describe it as stress. I describe it as suffering. Mm-hmm. that's really how we start creating our own suffering. So we start denying our experience, and we really start hiding out in our experience. And this is what disconnects us. First and foremost, it's really what disconnects us from ourselves. Yeah. Now, let me pause, because I think the other really critical part of this conversation is that none of us were taught how to do this. Mm-hmm. We just weren't. And we really sort of are not compassionate with ourselves and think that we're just supposed to know how to do that. We're just supposed to know how to be with our emotional energies. And we're not really taught to do that. As a matter of fact, we're real sort of taught to do the opposite in many ways. You know, kids, you know, young children sort of have this, and you can watch them do it. They'll get really upset and they, you know, have their moment and off they go, and they kind of forgot about it.
Yeah.
Right. And so to socialize us a little bit of this sort of gets, you know, sort of beaten out of us, for lack of a better term. But we have to really learn how to engage with our emotions and our inner life and let go of our judgment and be self-compassionate with ourselves. So in my world, there isn't really anything as a negative emotion. However, it helps people do experience certain emotional energies that way. And so yeah. it takes a lot of practice and really understanding what happens in our inner life to get adept at that and working with our emotions. Yeah.
Right. So to your point, right before you finished, you talked about, you know, learning how to deal with these emotions. And in the podcast, the main one that I was listening to in preparation for this, you and Marta described this idea of surviving and thriving, right? And when you are living in a fight or flight response, when you are fearful or angry or experiencing these tough emotions, it really shuts down and almost separates you from your prefrontal cortex. It makes it so that you're not able to be empathetic. You're not able to be creative. You're not able to be, you know, as intelligent or as thriving as possible, right? So that was just I've experienced that many, many times. right. I mean, just imagine for all of the DPT and PTA students out there, when you are stressed right before an exam, I mean, that almost shuts down your mental energy, right? It takes you away from what you're really trying to do, which seems counterintuitive, and almost like you'd think that stress would like push you to do more and more and more, but it is separating you from that, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's some data, you know, once you take a test, like 20% of the information leaves your head. So what you're really, you know, what you're talking about there is the fear response. And again, this is where we have to really give some reverence to our inner life and our emotional life. So you're starting to talk about what happens when we sort of get triggered and we get into more of our limbic response. Mm-hmm. And again, I can't say enough about this. I do think this is our greatest evolutionary challenge as humans, you know, if you will, to be able to know when we're in that response, when we're in a fear response that really isn't, there isn't really a threat to our physical being taking place, but it's more of a threat to our identity. You know, if I don't do well on a test, you know, and I know the students that are listening or anybody that's listening, but if I have a test coming up and, you know, maybe the rest of my time in the program is hinging on me doing well in this one class. I was in that situation once, you know, it's sort of, we've all had these moments and we can get into this fear response, which I like to think of it as sort of, a catastrophized future, which I learned several years ago, catastrophize isn't a word, I guess I made it up, but you know, where we're catastrophizing about what could happen in the future, or we're living from the past and we're really not here now. And so we can get into sort of this sort of toxic fear response with ourselves in this fight or flight mechanism. There are two other fear patterns as well, which are freeze and faint. And so we can get any of these fear mechanisms, and then our prefrontal cortex does go offline, and neurophysiologists have described this, that Dan Siegel is a guy I really love, and he does a great job of talking about, you know, how we flip our lid. He gives this example of when we get triggered enough, you know, we really can't think very clearly. And
right.
It is where our prefrontal cortex is where our empathy center is stored. And so it makes sense if we really understand ourselves as humans. And again, I can't come back enough to self-compassion for ourselves as we're learning this. And if we come back to how we're just sort of naturally wired as humans, this is sort of our response. And when we get triggered, you know, when we're in traffic, my greatest place to practice is in traffic. I live in Chicago, for those of you that don't know. So my favorite place to practice cruise is when I get triggered around how slowly traffic is moving. And we can understand then why we would see a person who we think is the cause of our issue, whether they are or not is always arguable, but as the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really part of the wiring of our brain. So I think our greatest challenge is to be able to, you know, we talk about it being more mindful, but really working with our brain and working with our neurophysiology and our body and our mind to really allow ourselves to be with our emotional experience so that we don't go outward and that it stays a healthy response for us and for others. So,
easier
said than done, right?
Right.
It's practice. And this is, you know, whatever the practices that people come to, you know, whether it's, I'm a huge fan of meditation and have been for years, and whatever the practice is, whatever the mindfulness practice, it really is about learning to work with ourselves. It's really about learning to work with our inner life so that we can bring that equanimity to our experience. And so that the real, you know, negative things don't sway us too hard. And by the way, even the real positive things, now this is going to sound really crazy, but even things happening that are really, really great in our life, we can have a tendency to not really handle those very well. All of us know the story of being, you know, I'm just going to shoot myself in the foot. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that metaphor exists, right?
Right.
So being able to bring an equanimity to all of our experience. Yeah.
Right. So just a couple analogies that I've heard in the past. So one more about being separated from your prefrontal cortex that I thought about while you were sharing yours was have you ever heard of, he got really mad and then he just saw red. And then it was all over. Like he just wasn't thinking anymore. So that one came to mind when you were talking. And then let's see, what was the one I just thought of right now? Anyway, we can come back to that later. But
all these metaphors, you know, I love metaphor because metaphor actually does put us more to our creative brain. But they all have some ounce of truth truth to them. You know, flip your lid. I saw red. All of these sorts of things. These metaphors are experiences, really.
Yeah.
That people, they put them in these just perfect wording are really helpful.
That's what it is. You just reminded me of that. So, you know, where you just described not getting too low or never getting too high. One of my mentors when I was in high school talked about just staying as consistent as possible and never getting too low, never getting too high, because when you get too high, you know, you can, we talked about this idea of getting a very big head and getting self-centered and becoming egotistical and we always try to stay away from that, always try to be as humble as possible. But it makes so much sense where if you just get positive reinforcement all the time, I mean, it seems like that can be just as detrimental as the negative stuff as well, right?
Well, yeah, you're sort of combining two concepts here that I think are both worthy of mentioning. So one is, you know, we can get a bit nihilistic about emotion. And to your point, you know, we should just stay even and be robots. Well, that's not very fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's very enjoyable. But when I talk about bringing equanimity to our experience is that we actually, and this is going to sound really crazy, you know, we can even enjoy sadness. You know, I don't know about you, but I've had moments where I've just had a really great cry. And it can feel just as wonderful as a great moment of laughing and sharing, you know, being with friends and laughing. So bringing equanimity to our experience is really, really part and parcel of, we can be with all experiences equally and not have to resist and fight them. Now, when you're talking about humility or, you know, getting feedback is what you're talking about, that, you know, you're bringing in a really interesting concept around celebration and what is it to celebrate, and how do we respond to other celebrations, and how do we allow ourselves to celebrate? And part of what you might be leading in there, I think, or how I'm going to turn this, because I think it's worthy talking about, is, do we allow ourselves to really celebrate, and do we allow ourselves to really have joy in our life? And I think just recently, and I don't think the NFL was thinking about it this way at all, but I think recently they changed their ruling on athletes celebrating in the end zone. I don't know, maybe one of our people who's joined us can comment on this, but I was really glad to see that, because I think we had really done a disservice by, like, you're going to get in the end zone, you're not to celebrate at all, because it was seen as taunting the other team. And I thought, well, you know, what if I just want to celebrate because I'm really happy?
Right.
So we have a way of dampening our joy just as much as we have a way of dampening any other emotional experience. And that doesn't allow us to really do a lot for thriving either. So I think it's worthy of honoring all of those things. And then Humility is a whole other part of the conversation. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Daphne, wow. So we're getting some comments right now. So everyone is loving the conversation. We're getting a ton of just likes and hearts and all that. So I just wanted to share that for you. I don't know if you could see all of that, but
I just see somebody put hashtag no fun league. I think that's really good. We can't have fun while we're playing sports. This is serious business.
Yeah, right. So for all of you that are watching right now, please start posting your questions for Daphne. Awesome. We just got our first one, so I'll read that in a second. But actually, Daphne, can you see those comments now?
A few, yeah. I can see some of them.
But, awesome.
You know, power people to manage their emotions and yeah.
Yeah. So this format is actually really nice because you can see everything. But everyone, for those of you that are watching, please start posting those questions because we have Daphne here and she's ready to answer your questions. So all right, this first one. So Mark asks, what are the healthy ways to empower patients and coworkers to manage their emotions within a professional setting?
Yeah, such a great question. Okay, so let's talk about this. So a couple of things. One is no one will really be able to go, when you're with another individual, no one will go further than you're able to go. So a lot of times, one of the things that you'll notice, and if you've been with a person who's, in all of our lives, it doesn't matter in physical therapy or not, we've sat with that person, or we've been around a friend, or we've sat with a loved one, or, and maybe water starts to come up behind their eyes and we can see they're about to cry. And it doesn't take very long for us to recognize how we relate to that based on our own response. So, Cruz, I'm sure you've had this experience. Someone starts to cry. I'm like, it's okay. We start to panic.
Really
that response, is really more about us and what we're comfortable with and what we aren't comfortable with. So, the more, again, that we can work within ourselves first, I always, and Marta, my assistant, makes fun of me when I say this, but the more that we can eat our own cooking, the better off that we are, right? And how we can work with our own inner life, the better off we are. So that's step one. But then there's the real practical applied part of this. So you're working with a patient and your patient starts to cry. And one of the most helpful things that we can do is really just be a witness to people and to just be with them. Recognize that there isn't anything to fix when someone starts having a response. Now, of course, there are boundaries, right? And I get parents that ask me about this a lot, because what if one kid is angry and he starts hitting the other one? it's like, hopefully in your work environment, that isn't happening. But, there are boundaries that need to be set. But for most of us with our adult experiences and our adult lives, really being with that person and allowing them to have their experience is the most beneficial thing that we can do. And to acknowledge it. So, again, this takes a little bit of skill, but to skip over another human's experience isn't really friendly either. And I'll give you an example. I was with my family yesterday, and I could tell that my brother was upset as soon as I got to the event. And so he's not a person who would do well with me calling that out in front of everybody. But once I went to the living room, and I said, "You seem upset." And he goes, "Yeah, I am." And I said, "Okay." And I just stood for a minute. And then I said, "I'm going to go get something to eat." And he said, "Okay." so he wasn't really asking me to do anything. He didn't say, "I want to talk about this" or anything. There was just an acknowledgement there that I see you, I'm with you. I can hear you. And it's okay. It's okay for him to have his moment of upsetness. So oftentimes we run in, and I think as healthcare providers, this is just a real dicey game. you know, we're, as a physical therapist, I was hired and paid and sought after to solve people's problems. That's what I was being paid to do. Well, now we get into people's emotional lives and we're dealing with all the complexities of that. And how far do we go in wanting to, you know, try to change someone or make them move their emotional energies? And really we get too far into other people's experience when we're doing that. So one of the best things we can do is be with. And then we can ask a person, and this is the second part of it, we can ask them, is there anything that you need right now from me? Is there anything that you need, or is just being with you enough? Hmm. And oftentimes people will say, you know, this is good. This is enough. You know, this is plenty. So with patients and coworkers alike, I saw there was a question about, you know, managing, you know, toxic work environments. That's a whole nother conversation, but just to be with another person can be helpful. And we'll talk more about venting and what's the difference. That's the stuff that really comes up in work environments that can have some toxicity to it. So yeah, that's one of the empathic responses that we can give.
Your comment there reminded me of a situation with my girlfriend. So she had something really important to share, and it was about her family, and we talked about the situation, and then I immediately brought up like 3 or 4 solutions that I thought of to solve the problem. And there was no solving the problem, right? And it was more like she just your advice. And she said this to me, and it struck me so much, and it's crazy that you just mentioned that again, because she was like, I don't need you to solve this problem. You know, I just want to tell you about it so we can talk about it. You know, I literally just want to talk about it. And that right there was like, wow, like, all right. You know, it was a very fair response and a genuine response. And I appreciated that. And that's when I, you know, realized that, okay, sometimes it's not about solving these problems. Cause I think of myself as a problem solver a lot of times, right? That's just my personality. I see problems and I think about opportunities, you know, but rather it was more of just like, let's just be right now. We can just talk about this and there doesn't have to be any problems. She just wanted to share, you know?
Yeah. And we just have this natural, you know, for my physical therapist on the phone, if you have not spent any time with motivational interviewing, I would highly recommend that you do that. And I saw a really great question come up that I want to get to too, around leaving it at the door that I want to come back to. But, you know, The motivational interviewing guys, Miller and Rolnick, really nailed something there. And they had a way of talking about it. And I have a different way of talking about it, but they called it the writing reflex. So we have it as humans, we want to be upright. But they said we sort of see a person struggling and we have this compulsion to fix it for them. And I don't know about you, but when somebody comes to you with a problem, it could be something you're even living in your life, but to give them the solution for theirs is so much easier for somebody.
Yeah, right.
And so we tend to want to get into advice giving really quickly. Now, my model with that is really comes from the drama triangle, which is a model that came from a gentleman, a psychologist in Canada. And so, you know, he talks about the victim, villain, hero. And so we do a lot of heroing. We get over into people's business and we want to fix things that really don't require us fixing. And mostly that comes from our own discomfort. So whether you call it the writing reflex or heroing, the whole point is that we're offering advice where people haven't asked for it. And we're really not able, when we're doing that, we're really not able to be present with people's moment by moment experience. And sometimes it's totally okay to say, well, would you like some input? And sometimes people will tell you, yeah, I really would. You know, you're a person of experience, or I think this comes up a lot in mentoring with physical therapists for sure. You know, you're a much more seasoned clinician when you know, giving input. And there are some models that really help us with that too. But just asking, you know, I'm with you, and would you like any input on this? You know,
right.
And sometimes people say, no, I really just want you to be with my experience, or, you know, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's a nice, easy way to just go ahead. Go ahead. You have another thing?
I do, because I want to talk about this idea of, quote, leaving it at the door when it comes to emotions. I just want to say really candidly, that's crazy. when you know, our emotional life is the biggest part of our decision making. And we really don't like to acknowledge this. We really try to act like we're just these rational, very logical beings that we put the pieces together. And that has its place. It absolutely does. But our inner life really matters. And the best model or metaphor, I guess, that I've heard about this comes from Jonathan Haidt. And he talks about the elephant and the rider. And it's just my favorite. The elephant is our emotional life, and the rider is our logical brain. You can see what he
meant. Wow. Idea,
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He does such a good job. It's written a lot about in the book Switch, if people wanted to look that up. But, you know, most of our life, our decisions are made from emotion through, you know, our heart space, through how things are going to make us feel, how things will make us, how we think we'll feel in the future. You know, what our decision, you know, we think this is going to give us a certain feeling. And again, that's the part where we can get in this big jangle on it. Like when it comes to eating, you know, who can eat this cake so it'll feel good now? What's going to feel like in the future? But we really do ourselves a disservice. And emotions have an intelligence to them. You know, emotions have a wisdom to them that we really miss out on when we try to not pretend that they're not there.
Right, right. Can you quickly, before we get into the next question, can you quickly just talk about all emotions coming out of the same hose, like you described in your podcast, and when you're kinked, because not being able to feel one emotion, like you described, really limits your ability to feel all emotions, right?
Yeah. So again, if we come back to the basic idea that they are sensations occurring in and out of the body, any sensations that we can't be with, you know, they're not perfectly mapped, obviously, but yeah, anytime that we're limited. So if I can't really experience sadness, what's really true is I'll get to only a certain ability of experiencing authentic joy. The same with anger. You know, if I can only experience a certain level of that or can't experience that at all, I won't be able to experience other parts of my emotional life. However, a lot of times, that being said, a lot of times it can help us to work with one of them for a bit of time. You know, if you're a person who just really avoids sadness, maybe that's the place to start to play and see if that, you know, if that feels safe for you and feels comfortable for you to start experiencing that. What does it feel like to go into that emotional experience with yourself? So they do all of our energies, because energy is energy.
Right.
So it all settles in the same place. Yeah. And so we kind of can work with these in a, you know, that's where our rational brain is really helpful. It helps us make sense. It helps us categorize things, and it can be really helpful to do that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. Amelia Sullivan asks, what are your thoughts in the never mind, we just talked about leaving at the door.
Yeah, I just that comment, and I thought that's really
awesome. No, that's great. So we answered that one. Ryan Madry asks, how would you tease out the difference between distress and eustress in the workplace?
Very good. So let's talk about this idea of stress. So probably the best talk I've ever heard on the idea of stress. So again, keep in mind that stress is a word. It's a construct. It's pointing us to something, as most of these words are that we're talking about. So construct is like the weather, right? If I said, what's the weather? You would give me, you know, it's barometric pressure, it's rain, it's, you know. So stress is a construct. Now, what happens is, and this is when they started making some distinctions, and they said, well, some stress is okay. So for all my therapists with us tonight, you know, some stress is okay. Like if I work my muscle, that's going to put my muscle under stress. We need that. That's good.
Yeah.
You know, eustress is good. Distress, though, is when we're no longer capable of managing what's happening in our lives, or we start to feel overwhelmed by what's occurring. Now, what's true is that's different for everyone. However, the talk that I love the most on this topic is from Kelly McGonigal, McGonigal, and you can find her TED talk. And she was one of our lecturers when I was at the University of Pennsylvania in the positive psychology program. And she really unhooks us from this idea of just stress in and of itself, that we have given stress, and I think this is why distress and eustress become really valuable to us, that we've given the word stress a really bad name. And she points to some crazy research that shows that people who believed, so this is really
cool.
People who believed that stress was bad for them, without having any, you know, really formal definition of what we meant by stress to begin with, that people who believed that stress was bad for them died sooner than people who didn't. And it's a crazy study, and you can find it, it's in one of her books as well. But so, you know, distress starts to occur for us, and it's different for every person, but definitely when we start to feel as though we're being overwhelmed by life, that we no longer have the capacity to manage. And there's just no substitute in those instances for getting help. And what do I mean by getting help? That can be from friends, that can be from family, that can be from a therapist, it can be from a coach, it can be from a trusted advisor in your life, but someone that can really help you make sense of your experience, whether that be your inner life, your emotional experience, or your cognitive life, your thought experience, is really helpful. And it's different for every person. There's just no way of saying what's going to be stressful for you, Cruz, is going to be completely different for me. And that's what we talk about, preferred, non-preferred events, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I like the idea that they've made these distinctions between just sort of stress that we need, things that can feel when we're on a growth edge that may require grit, which has been talked about, things when we're stretching and expanding ourselves, but that our skill level isn't being exceeded for the thing that we're trying to manage through. It's when our skill level starts to get exceeded by what we're having to manage through that we start to experience distress and uncomfortable levels of stress in our lives. Yeah.
Right.
I hope that answered the question, but.
Oh, I'm sure it did. And I saw Ryan drop a bunch of hearts. So I'm sure he, I'm sure he really liked that one. Okay. Let's see.
Can I expand on that just a little bit more?
Please.
I know we have other questions, but I just want to say a word to everyone. You know, getting help and getting support for our emotional life, our inner life, our mental health, I can't say enough about this. And I think we have really done ourselves a disservice by not recognizing our own capacities and some of the limitations in our capacities for how we work with our inner life. And whether that be, you know, getting help from a therapist or whomever, but really being able to talk about that or a trusted friend, we really can have this sort of idea that because we're not managing some part of our life well, that says something about us as humans. We start to get into judgment and criticism with ourselves that, oh, I should be able to handle this. I really coached new moms in our therapy world on this. You know, their lives are completely opposite, you know, and no, it's 9 months, but it's almost overnight. And they kind of come to their reality, like that they should be handling everything as they did before.
Yeah,
there's a lot of judgment and criticism, and I think if we can just start to recognize that life, you know, it's gonna help us to expand one way or the other, and sometimes you just need help. You need support.
Yeah. Right.
Most of the time,
really. Right. And no one is immune, right? No one is immune.
No one.
So, yeah.
No.
Self-included. Yeah, that's great.
I went through a divorce last year, and there's just no, had it not been for a therapist, my best friend, my assistant, Marta, also a best friend, you know, all these people in my life. I mean, there were moments that I truly was brought to my knees that I had not anticipated. And without that support, that's really not, it's, you can't get your best growth. You know, we want to grow and expand. So I recommend everybody just keep that in mind for themselves as they're working with your emotional life and becoming more adept at working with that we keep that in mind.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
like a real person.
Yeah. okay. So let's see. We have Daphne. We have about 9 minutes left until our hour is done. But we have a couple questions left. How are you doing on time? Can we go a little further?
I'm great. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So let's see. Megan Mitchell asks, I read a book on mindfulness about the concept that only negative emotion is a stuck emotion. A stuck emotion being an emotion that lasts 8 seconds. What are your thoughts about this and how it plays into the concept of a good cry?
Okay, such a great question. So what the research tells us is that true emotional energy, you know, again, the experience of sensations occurring in and on the body, really come in anywhere from, you know, 8 seconds to 60 seconds, 90 seconds, waves. And if you pay attention to, you know, we'll use crying. I love crying. But if you pay attention to your emotional life, you know, again, if you start to note, if you can give yourself the moment of noticing how your emotion works in your body, you'll experience this. It'll kind of come and it will fall. When we allow it to move, what happens is we don't go into so much what we're aware of or what we'll know is ruminating. What causes an emotion to recycle itself is that we don't allow it to move. We sort of stuff it in some way. All the judgments and criticisms start. And the mind actually jumps in. And the mind is really quick. It is so fast. And this is why an untrained mind is difficult to work with sometimes, because as soon as you start to have an experience, your mind jumps in. It goes, that's bad. Don't be angry. Stuff it. get it under control. Whoa, you're about ready to slide off the cliff here. Hey, you're at work. Shut it down, you know. But then your mind starts going, you should tell that guy off. And you're driving down the road and you think of comebacks, you know, 5 days.
Oh, my God, yes. I was just about to say that happens all the time where I'll think about, like, a scenario. And I will play out the whole scenario in my mind. Yes. Go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
Right. No, it does, right? I mean, there's a whole Seinfeld episode on this, you know, where George is like, jerk story. He thinks of it like 5 days later. You know? So it's like you're trying to come up with a comeback. I should have said this. And so what if we, again, don't take my word for it, by the way. I encourage everyone to have their own experience with this. But if you pay attention, if you really can pay attention in a non-judgmental way to your experience, what you'll find is that there was an emotion, there was something that started in the body, and there was a way that you just wanted to stop that from occurring. So what they were talking about sounds like in that mindfulness book, and I don't know what book it was, but what they were talking about is that, again, if we can learn to be with the experience and just come back to the body, literally the body, and notice what's occurring in the body, heat, tingling, labeling it anger, more heat and tingling, and not get caught up in the mind and trying to get it to go away or problem solving it or, you know, what's our comeback going to be or what's our strategy going to be. What we'll find is that all those strategies, and there might be some action to be taken. So it doesn't mean that there might not be. There might be, but that action will be taken from a place of true presence. It won't be taken from a place of being in reaction to the emotion. So that's probably what they were talking about in that book. But again, this is practice. I don't recommend practicing with your most difficult emotions or your most difficult, you know, practice with the easy ones first.
So yeah. Can I ask just a follow-up question on that? So I'd say one of the things that I personally struggle with is like things that, I don't know, I can't think of any specific example, but when I get angry, there's moments where I can catch myself and I can breathe and I can think about, like, you know, I'm just curious, maybe a little more tips on how to be with that experience. Because I know for me, especially, like, if I get angry, I don't know, my dog pooped on my carpet or something, you know, like it's difficult. It's difficult. There are times when I'm like, okay, I'm going to breathe through this. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to be with this experience. But then there are times when it's really tough to deal with that. Right. Do you have any other tips?
I do.
For being with those emotions, especially one like anger?
Yeah, I do. So here's the one thing. If you can do it once in one situation, it's only a matter of time before you'll be able to do it in many, many situations. So practice. And I think what's most important is that recognizing that it might not be in all situations. And this is why self-compassion is so important. Mm-hmm. There may be that moment where, you know, you can handle the dog doing its business on your carpet pretty well, but not so much when your boss, you know, or someone important to you loses it on you or sends you an email that's misinterpreted. So,
right.
So again, allowing yourself to see like, oh, I'm not managing this so well. This seemed really important to me. How can I really give myself some support and some love in this moment? And maybe you said something you really regretted. You know, and you go back to work the next day or you go home that night and you're like, wow, I really feel sad that I reacted that way or that I said things. There is just no substitute for going back and owning that if it was with another person and owning that with the other person and saying, you know, yesterday I really lost my patience.
Yeah.
I know that I was responding from anger. I said some things that I really didn't mean. I wasn't present and I just wasn't being with my emotions the way that I could that would have been best for me and for you. And I just want to own that with you. So that, you know, that's a self-compassionate response at the same time that it's recognizing the response possibly of the other person without getting into their business and taking more than your 100% responsibility, but owning it and then giving yourself that moment of grace and you'll practice again.
Yeah.
Right. So there's never any benefit in my experience of going back and living in the past. Where we can really, and the only place where we can take responsibility is in the present. So as soon as we notice, you know, maybe that we didn't have the most savory response we would have liked to have had, or as soon as we notice, you know, we get home and we have that moment of clarity, which you will, everyone, you know, you will, you've calmed down your whole life about your things, right? It's like something you stayed, got angry once and you just stayed angry the rest of your life. So you had moments of calm. And so we can go back to that and like, oh, okay. You know, I had these moments of calm and now I'm home and I'm regretting something that I said, or I'm noticing I would have liked to have had that gone differently. We can just go back you know, and just clean that up and then know that you'll, there's an opportunity to do it again. I think the thinking trap that we get stuck in around many things in our life, the big thinking trap is all or nothing thinking. That because we messed it up once, that means we're done. You know, we didn't, this isn't, we're done. I ate the potato chip and now my diet is ruined or my health is ruined. And it's over.
Right.
You know, all it's required is a recommitment. So if you're a person who really wants to get adept at working with their inner life and their emotional energies, you just keep recommitting over and over again, over and over. You have to have a commitment first.
Yeah. Right.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's great. As you mentioned something right at the beginning that reminded me one more time of the podcast when you and Marta described this idea of anger is always underlined by fear. And, it is this fight, flight, freeze, and faint response really kind of taking over you. And you guys also described the idea that this response was created as a way to keep us alive, right? But now in our modern age, as you described in the podcast, we're not really in physical danger a whole lot, especially in you know our society as we see it. But it's more of an idea of taking away a need or something that is related to our identity. So I think about this idea. Okay, you know, my dog pooped on my carpet, right? Well, what I needed was for my dog to use the restroom outside, or I needed my carpet to be clean, or, you know, I have guests coming over or something like that, you know, where it takes something away that, man, I really wanted that to go this way, right? Yeah. So, that's, so you just literally reminded me of that with something that you said, but thank you for answering that question. Megan says, thank you for the answer. That was brilliant. So,
so awesome, Megan.
Yeah. All right. So let's see. Moving right along, we have three questions left. So Tyler asks, what are some ways to balance empathy for patients and their families, especially for those near the end of life, and keeping the experience of others from causing adverse negative effects on ourselves as providers, such as things like burnout, fear, catastrophization?
Yeah. So let me address this two parts of that question. So let me address the first part around, you know, when we're working with patients who maybe are near the end of life, there are some times that words cannot be spoken. There are some events in life that really require no words and really require a presence and being with. So I would encourage everyone, you know, as healthcare providers, depending on the environment that you're in, and I've been very blessed. I worked in outpatient orthopedics, so I hadn't had a lot of those moments, but I had some. And there are just these moments, or maybe you hear a really horrible story, and there are just some moments where words can't be spoken. So I think for providers to stay healthy and engaging with those, allowing yourself to have your emotional experience can be helpful. Again, trying to pretend that you're a robot, that, you know, someone's really ill. Someone's not, you know, doing well, you really being able to be with that in a healthy way for yourself is beneficial. Trying to stop the emotional energy isn't helpful. Now, there can be moments when, and again, and I think this is why there aren't hard and fast rules. And I would encourage everyone to, again, stay away from this idea that there are hard and fast rules, because context matters. You know, we kind of want hard and fast rules because I think we just want to not have to, we want to make sure we're doing the right thing. I think it's what, you know, caused some of our profession to get in a lot of trouble. Like, there's a magic bullet. I mean, I remember in 1997 reading, I think it was 97 or 99, reading an article about, you know, the magic bullet for low back pain. You know, we were going to find the one way to treat low back pain. And I think it's, you're right, it doesn't exist. And thank goodness. And, you know, the same thing with our emotional life. So that when we're working with a patient, I think what's most important for any provider is to just be as present as you can and just ask yourself what's called for now, because no one's going to be able to tell you. You know, your context is going to be different. The patient's going to be different. The thing you just heard or saw or said or whatever is just, it's always going to be different. So really coming back to what's most called for now. And I think trusting yourself that you're going to be able to respond, not react, but respond in a way that's going to be really beneficial for you and the patient and the family, if the family's involved at large. So trusting yourself in those responses The second thing I want to say about empathy is there is a conversation taking place around this idea of empathy fatigue for providers. And I want to tell you this is if I had a soapbox, Cruz, this is where it is. You cannot be a healthy provider if you're incapable of taking care of yourself, whether that means, setting healthy boundaries. And we, as therapists, we've gone into the helping professions because out of pro-social concern. We want to be helpful to other people. We want to support people. And however, if you aren't willing and able to take care of yourself and take care of your own emotional life, to take care of your own needs, to allow your needs to get met, you really can't be helpful to others. And I think this is the thing that really contributes to burnout. Yeah. I think that therapists aren't taking care of themselves, I'll tell you a story from my young career. I would warn my new grads when they'd start. I'm like, you will oversleep within the first 3 months of working. Mm. They're like, no, I won't. And I'm like, you will. Because they weren't used to being on their feet. Now we have, longer levels of clinical education, and handling that whole caseload and handling that energy output. And it's a lot of output when you're with a patient. You're listening to people. People are in pain. They're not feeling well. And so how you take care of yourself in the micro moments, not only the big moments, but the micro moments each day really matter. Rest and renewal every moment of every day, stepping away, taking a breath, getting a drink of water, inhaling and exhaling, getting present with what you're doing. Those are all ways of managing energy throughout the day that I think is really viable for clinicians and for people who are in the helping professions.
Yeah. I had a conversation. This was during my first clinical rotation. So I was at a level one trauma center. It was an acute inpatient. And at my midterm CPI, my CI and I discussed this idea of this, I don't know, just burnout was a topic. And because, I had never seen some of the stuff that I had seen during that rotation. Right. And I went home and I would try and verbalize some of the stuff to my girlfriend that I saw. And I was crying a lot. I know a lot of people have had a similar situation, but, acute, level one trauma, just high amount of just problems going on, people were not there having their best days. You know what I mean? Right. So, it's true. Yeah. It's so true. It's different in different settings, but I remember that conversation because we talked about, the difference between her and I was that she had seen just a lot more. She had experienced a lot more and it was kind of interesting because she described this idea of becoming desensitized to some of these things, right? As she's seen more and more and more of it. But
Let's talk about that for a minute. Because this is one of the things that starts to come into the conversation of burnout. When they talk about therapists who can stay, and they looked at this in mental health professionals in particular, and it was a dissertation that was done. This gentleman described it as exquisite empathy. And I loved it. Exquisite empathy, meaning there's a way that you can turn towards another human being who may be in some suffering and in a way that actually keeps you in connection with yourself and with them. You don't take on their problems.
Yeah.
Right? And
I
think that's where we start to get over in people's business that isn't ours, but we can turn towards each other as humans and still maintain a healthy boundary. But we don't have to deny our emotions or our feelings. We don't have to pretend. We don't have to. The idea that we would desensitize ourselves, I think, is really probably what starts to happen when we burn out. Because, again, to your point earlier, Cruz, which you caught so quickly, anytime we start shutting ourselves down around our emotional life, we're going to kink it everywhere. That hose is going to get kinked everywhere. Right. So we might get more used to the stories or something of that nature, get more adept at handling and navigating those situations. But there is some suffering that we watch humans go through that it is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking for us. And so depending on, where we are as physical therapists in scenarios, and I had worked with a couple of women's health therapists that had really encountered some horrible situations as they were working with patients, stories that they had to hear, that were just heartbreaking. Yeah. And it's worthy of us to honor those stories and ourselves and to know that we have to give our own emotional life some patience and be patient with ourselves if we haven't been prepared for those moments and get help where we need it too. Mm-hmm. But really taking exquisite care of ourselves, I think, is what really matters. You know, having a mindfulness practice, having a way that you renew your energy, knowing what that looks like in the macro and the micro is, I think, really what creates long-term careers around our emotional life.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're bringing up some really good points.
Yeah.
Making me look like a rock star is what you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, two more questions. So let's see. Sarah asks, if a patient's emotional episode is starting to take the majority of the treatment time, how do you find the balance between empathizing with the patient and professionally getting back to the treatment session? That's good.
That's good.
I've experienced that many a times. Good. That's a good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. So here's one of the things that I think is really important is really asking the patient if they feel that they're able to continue with their treatment. Again, we don't know, and you can't, you know, I like to use this metaphor, you know, you can't force a rose to open. So if someone's really stuck, if someone's really having an emotional experience, maybe that day is not going to be the day to, you know, continue. I'm not sure what environment this is in, but to continue with the formal treatment. And so allowing the person to have a moment and then just simply asking them, do you feel like today is going to be a day for us to get through the treatment that I had planned for you? Is today going to be the day for that? And would you like to take a break or would you like to be done for today? And would you like to come back at another time? And not having an attachment to that either way. So we can sort of get so focused on, you know, and I used to do this too, so guilty as charged, you know, this is what I have to get done today. And this is what, you know, this is what this patient's going to get.
Right.
And then what would happen? The patient would come in and had a horrible argument with their boyfriend and they fell down the stairs. And you know, it's just like, you're like, I have five other people behind you that I need to get to, you know? Right.
Right.
I mean, this is the realities of everyday practice. And so how adept we become at, you know, being able to be with that person's experience in the moment, giving it some time to let that energy move itself. And then to just say, you know, you seem upset and would you like to continue today? Or how would you like to be? Does this feel, what I like to ask people is, does this feel friendly to you to be here?
Mm.
Does it feel friendly for you to be here? And I have this happen in groups. I was with one group where a woman had recently lost her husband. And here we're talking about meditation and getting in touch with our bodies. And, you know, and I just asked her, I said, does it feel friendly for you to be here right now? And she said, it does, actually. This is really helpful. And I said, okay, great. You know, that's then by all means, be here. But letting the person make the choice about what's best for them in the moment really empowers people. It allows them to see that they really are in control of what's happening in their lives. And that would be my recommendation in that, and to feel through the situation and see what's required.
That is genius. Yeah,
well,
I mean,
you know.
Yeah.
I'm a genius.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know about that. I've done it wrong a lot.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I should say that I've done it in ways that have been less effective. Let me say it that way.
Okay. Gotcha. No, I'm definitely going to try that one. I mean, there's been some times where it's like, you know, it's tough to navigate that. So, that is a really, really, really good way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. Daphne, we're at the last question. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. I want to just, appreciate you, Cruz, for putting this together. Inviting me to do this with you and for the time that you took to listen to my other podcast. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm always so honored when people will listen to me talk for 30 minutes. So it means a lot to me, and I'm glad that you brought this conversation into the fold, and I hope it was helpful to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. Last question. So, how would you suggest fixing a tense and unhealthy work environment? I think this was the question where we talked about the toxic work environment, right?
Yeah. Well, that is such a big question. And it requires many, many, many moving pieces. Recognition from the top that's happening. It's, you know, when I say top, what I mean is that there's a hierarchy in the organization, which some have and some don't now, that there's a recognition that there's an unhealthy environment. That's a really complicated question for lots of reasons. What I would say, though, is it all starts at home. So the best that we can do if we're in that situation as individuals is to ask ourselves what can we change and take responsibility for that. What can't we change? And if it's to a level where the things that can't be changed are so much of a distraction from us, from being our best and doing our best work, that maybe those are the situations where we find somewhere else to do our work and to give our gifts to the world and to patients. But that's a really, really big question. I'd be happy to talk about that more.
But that's
a really big one. But it all starts at home. That's the place we can take responsibility.
Yeah. I do have one thing in listening to other podcasts of yours where you've talked about this idea of only doing your 100%. You don't have to do other people's 100%, just yours. And this idea of being above the line or below the line. Can you talk about that? I think that would really, you know, help clear this up.
Yeah. So I just want to honor Joseph Campbell, who really, you know, really sort of came up with this model. And it's really how we look at our own, what's happening in our own consciousness, within our own conversations in our head. And are we open? Are we open, curious, and more interested in learning? Or that's above the line, when we find ourselves below the line, being closed, defensive, and really more interested in being right. And this is a big one for our identities. You know, we just really like to be right about our perspective. We like to be right about our thoughts and our beliefs, and we really can grind down on those. So when we find ourselves back to more or less than 100%, we usually are below the line when we're not in the sweet spot of 100%. In other words, when we're really just not controlling what we can control, what's in our influence, we usually find ourselves somewhere below the line. So wanting to be right about our perspective and wanting to defend that perspective and closing off to other perspectives, for example, or other ways people might experience the world. And it doesn't mean that we all are, you know, unicorns and rainbows about that. It can mean a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's just that we start to get more into reality about, wow, this, you know, maybe I'll bring it back to work. You know, maybe this environment isn't the best for me. And I'm sad about that. And I have some anger about that. And maybe it's best for me not to be here. Or you'd be like, you know, I see how this happens over there, and I can work with that and live with that, and I don't have to be right about it. And when given the choice, I'll choose over here, and I'll work this way and do my work that way. But that's the freedom that we have available to us, and to be able to change the things that we can, you know, and be in our own responsibility versus fighting reality. So
yeah.
That helpful.
That was great. Okay. Daphne, we are at the end. We did this. We fought the technical difficulties at the beginning, which there were many for those of viewers. Thank you for sticking with us. Really, really means a lot. Please, everyone, join me in giving a round of applause, and, you know, lots of likes, tweets, everything. Please, over to Daphne for taking the time to join us tonight. So, please follow her, Daphne. How can people connect with you if they would like to do that in the future?
Yeah. So I definitely through my podcast. I have two podcasts now. Actually, I have the Super Fantastic Leadership Show podcast. I also have on Evidence in Motion with Evidence in Motion, now the EIM Inside Leadership podcast. So what you'll hear on that podcast is a lot more about sort of our consciousness. I do. I collaborate with Dr. Rob Wehner, who is a executive coach within Confluent Health. So you'll hear us on the show. I do a lot of different things on that show. So those are two ways. And then, of course, I have a blog that I write. You know, you can read on my blog. I have my online courses, which are coming very soon here in the fall. So I'm really excited about that. Those will be launched by October. Yeah, I'm really excited to bring a lot of this material, just in being able to, you know, give that people more access in that way versus me doing live trainings. And those are some of the ways. And then anytime, you know, my Twitter handle at Daphne Scott. I love to engage with people. So you can find me on Twitter for sure, and Facebook.
Awesome. Daphne, thank you one more time for your time, and thank you to all the live viewers. We're all done, so we will finish this, but it will all be documented if anyone needs to see it again in the future. So, all right. Bye, everyone. Have a good night.